Imagine finding out that the guy who helped teach you your ABCs on Sesame Street also directed, well, mob-funded underground adult films.
Right. And in the house of a district attorney, of all places.
Exactly. Now hold that thought and imagine that same man's son is currently at the center of a horrific modern-day serial killer investigation.
I mean, it really sounds like the plot of a deeply unsettling thriller. You have this jarring collision of, wholesome pop culture, 1970s gritty organized crime, and a present-day house of horrors that just completely defies belief.
It really does. Welcome to today's deep dive. We have two incredibly wild, wildly contrasting sources on the table for you today that somehow inexplicably merge into a single terrifying
This is
narrative.
quite a lineup.
Yeah, so first we're looking at a breaking 2026 news report from the Hindustan Times. It details this gruesome true crime mystery unfolding right now in Philadelphia involving a potential serial killer.
And on the other side, we have a 2026 transcript from a show called The Rialto Report, which features a massive retrospective interview with a self-described sociopathic villain from the 1970s named Ray Horsch.
Putting these two sources side by side is, well, it's what makes this so compelling for anyone listening. You're reading a historical account of a man proudly detailing his decades of underground criminality right next to breaking news about his own son's unimaginable crimes.
It really forces you to look at the anatomy of a deeply disturbed family tree.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. We are going to explore the bizarre, taboo-shattering life of Ray Horsch. We'll trace his wild leap from creating live-action clips for children's television straight into the darkest corners of the 1970s adult film industry,
A pretty massive leap.
to say the least. Then we are going to uncover how his legacy of criminality and dark performance art connects to the horrifying modern-day investigation involving his son. Okay, let's unpack
To
this.
really get a grip on this puzzle, you have to understand the environment Ray Horsch was operating in and, more importantly, how his mind worked.
Right.
He wasn't just a criminal of opportunity. He was a man who openly admitted he spent his life viewing societal norms, any kind of boundary, really as an obstacle that he took immense pleasure in dismantling.
So let's start with those origins, because if you are picturing a hardened street thug, you're going to get whiplash.
Yeah.
In the late 1960s and early 70s, Ray Horsch is a freelancer.
A very specific kind of freelancer.
Yeah, he's making these little 2 or 3 minute live action educational clips for the Children's TV Workshop.
And for anyone unfamiliar with that corporate name, that is the production company behind Sesame Street.
Big Bird, Elmo, learning how to count to 10. It is literally the most wholesome, heavily sanitized, positive environment imaginable. But Ray's career trajectory takes a pivot that is almost legendary in its absurdity.
It all starts with him just wanting to grab a beer. Right.
Literally just a beer.
Yeah.
He goes to meet up with a friend who happens to be a sound man. But the friend is still on the clock, so Ray ends up wandering onto his friend's job site in New York.
And that job site happens to be a rather chaotic adult film set. This is 1969. He walks onto this set, and the production is in the middle of an absolute meltdown. The lead actor, a guy named Harry Reams, has a physical malfunction, let's call it.
Let's call it that.
But worse than that, the massive 35-millimeter camera jams.
Yeah.
He loses his moment. The crew is incredibly frustrated, and they just cannot get the scene back on track.
You have to understand the mechanics of 1960s filmmaking to know why they were panicking so much. They are shooting on heavy, expensive 35-millimeter film stock.
Burning through cash.
Exactly. They're burning through it at 90 feet a minute. Every second that camera is rolling without getting the shot is burning cash they absolutely don't have. The day is basically over and the director is desperate.
And in this moment of high-stakes stress, Ray, who explicitly notes in the Rialto report that he didn't have the typical look or, the athletic build of an adult film star, he just steps up.
He
He
volunteers.
literally drops his towel. He stands there in the middle of the room, fully naked, and offers to do the final necessary shot for $100.
Talk about confidence.
For anyone who isn't up on their 1960s adult film lingo, they needed what's called a pop shot, essentially, the money shot, the final explicit moment required to definitively finish the scene. He tells the director to count backward from 10, and when they hit zero, he performs on cue.
He was hired on the spot. And keep in mind, $100 in 1969 was serious money. It translates to over $1,000 today for just a few seconds of work.
It's like finding out Mr. Rogers moonlighted as an extra in Taxi Driver. The juxtaposition is just insane to me.
Oh, totally.
But he didn't just take his $100 and go back to Sesame Street. This bold, chaotic move sparked a total transition into the adult film world. And he wasn't just doing quick fill-in shots either.
No, he leaned right in.
He immediately started leaning into dark, dramatic roles. His very first actual acting job in this industry was playing a deranged, switchblade-wielding rapist chasing a woman down a stairwell.
And that desire to merge violence, taboo, and performance, it didn't stay on the screen. He took this into the physical world, right into the Times Square sex clubs, during the absolute height of the 42nd Street grindhouse era.
The source describes these clubs as incredibly grim. Ray and his girlfriend, who interestingly enough was a medical student at the time, would go up to these clubs on the weekends.
Right.
For $40, they would get up on a slightly raised, 8-foot square, filthy mattress in the middle of a room and just perform rough sex acts in front of a live, paying audience.
Wow.
He called it a slave girl motif, where he would purposefully treat her terribly, slapping her around, leaning right on the razor's edge of what was legally or socially acceptable.
What's fascinating here is his underlying motivation. If you analyze his answers in the Rialto report, you quickly realize it wasn't really about the $40, and it wasn't even strictly about the mechanical act of sex.
What was it, though?
It was the psychological thrill of exhibitionism. He was fueled by a deep-seated rebellion. He viewed himself as this elite nonconformist who derived immense pleasure from shocking ordinary people.
I see.
The sex and the violence were just the vehicles. The real thrill was the performance art of crossing boundaries while people watched.
But just being the performer on a dirty mattress clearly wasn't enough to satisfy that kind of ego. I mean, if you are that obsessed with crossing boundaries, eventually you need to be the one drawing the lines.
You want to be the architect.
Exactly. And that perfectly explains his next major pivot. He wanted to direct.
Yeah.
He wanted to create his own movie, to push the envelope further than anyone else was willing to go.
He wanted complete control of the narrative. So in 1973, he decides to write and direct a film called The Erotic Memoirs of a Male Chauvinist Pig.
Quite the title.
Yeah. But to make a feature-length film, you need capital. And a guy like Ray isn't walking into Chase Manhattan for a small business loan.
No, definitely not. He goes straight to the Philadelphia mob. He partners with an Italian mobster known as Sam the Barber, who ran a notoriously rough Philly bar called the Bag of Nails.
Sam puts up the majority of the money for this project.
They scrape together a budget of just over $20,000, and they decide to shoot it on 16mm film.
Which was a massive, highly strategic technical choice for the era. The specific 16mm Eclair camera they used actually revolutionized underground filmmaking.
How so?
Well, it was lightweight, it could record synchronized sound without needing a massive heavy blimp to muffle the motor noise, and most importantly, it allowed them to shoot quickly and stealthily on real-world locations rather than expensive sound stages.
And they desperately needed that stealth because of the sheer audacity of where they were shooting. This is the detail in the source material that genuinely broke my brain.
It's wild.
This mob-funded, boundary-pushing adult film was shot in part at the house of the wife of a Philadelphia district attorney. Let that sink in.
Well, it's unbelievable.
But it doesn't stop there. The film actually had a mainstream premiere at the 1812 Theater right in the center of Philly, and staff from the district attorney's office actually attended the premiere.
Complete with Hollywood-style searchlights sweeping the sky outside.
Yeah.
It was a massive public spectacle.
I am genuinely struggling to understand the DA connection here. How does someone with this much disdain for authority manage to convince law enforcement adjacent people to host a mob-funded porn shoot? Was the DA's office just profoundly corrupt in the 70s, or was Ray just an apex predator when it came to manipulation?
It leans heavily toward the latter. Ray was a master of manipulation. He openly admitted in the Rialto transcript that he was deeply duplicitous. The psychology here is textbook sociopathy. He knew exactly how to mirror people's expectations.
So he just lied to them.
To the DA's wife, he likely didn't pitch a mob-funded porn film. He weaponized upper-class sensibilities, probably framing the project as an avant-garde European-style student film, or maybe a cheeky, harmless comedy. He used a facade of artistic legitimacy to gain access to spaces he had no business being in.
And once he was in those spaces, the actual agenda was incredibly dark. Male Chauvinist Pig wasn't just standard 1970s adult fare. It aggressively broke every taboo imaginable for the time.
It really did.
The sources mention it included heavy S&M, bondage, simulated rape scenes, and a highly disturbing trope involving an underage Catholic schoolgirl.
Ray claimed he packed the film with these taboos deliberately as a dark parody. He argued it was a high-concept satire meant to mock the very people paying to watch it. He wanted to hold a mirror up to the depravity of the consumer.
But the irony is the audience totally missed the joke. The underground circuit just treated it as standard, albeit extreme, pornography. His supposed artistic commentary was completely swallowed up by the raw, explicit nature of what he actually put on the screen.
They just wanted the shock value.
Exactly.
But while the artistic nuance might have been lost on the crowd, the financial return was staggering. The film was a massive hit. It actually reached number 42 on the Billboard charts for top-grossing films in the entire country, which is absurd for an underground mob project.
Unbelievable.
But the wealth didn't exactly trickle down to the visionary.
Right. Follow the money. Sam the Barber, the mob backer, allegedly made millions of dollars off Male Chauvinist Pig. Ray, the writer, director, and mastermind, walked away with exactly $50,000.
Still a good chunk of change.
Yeah, I mean, 50 grand in 1973 is still a fantastic return on a $20,000 budget. If you are a smart filmmaker, you take that capital, you look at what made you successful, and you build an empire. You make a sequel. But Ray's contrarian nature takes the wheel.
He decides to fund a passion project.
Mm-hmm.
And this project is a literal cinematic Catholic black mass.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because Ray decided to film this black mass entirely from start to finish, spoken completely in Latin.
In Latin.
For you listening, if you aren't familiar with the concept of a black mass, it is historically considered the ultimate taboo in Western religion. It is a direct, intentional inversion and desecration of the Catholic Eucharist and its sacred rituals. It is designed to be as offensive to the church as humanly possible.
And Ray thought this would be his masterpiece. But it was a massive, unmitigated commercial disaster. Think about his target demographic. The adult film audience of 1970s Times Square had absolutely zero interest in a deeply theological, Latin-spoken cinematic black mass.
Obviously.
They couldn't understand a word of it.
It bombed spectacularly. And after just one single screening, the Catholic Archdiocese in Philadelphia caught wind of it. They stepped in and used their considerable political and social clout to completely shut down the film's run.
It was buried.
Ray lost his entire fortune. He blew every dime he made from his first hit.
He was left at absolute ground zero.
I have to play devil's advocate here. If he is this self-proclaimed genius sociopath, a guy who successfully manipulated the Philly mob in the district attorney's office, why blow it all on a Latin black mass? Hmm. Was his desire to offend the Catholic Church really stronger than his desire to stay rich and powerful?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of Ray's psychology, it actually makes perfect sense.
Huh.
Ray was not driven by sound business logic, and he didn't care about wealth accumulation. He was an adrenaline junkie.
Okay, that tracks.
He was driven by technical challenges and, most importantly, by the thrill of crossing lines. His overarching goal was always to provoke a reaction. He admitted his main motivation for the black mass was simply to do something contrary, to intentionally antagonize the most powerful institution he could find, just to see what would happen.
Well, what happened was it triggered his total downfall. Losing everything sent him into a deep year-long depression. And when he eventually climbed out of it, he didn't go back to the camera right away.
No, he found new hobbies.
He pivoted into even more brazen, bizarre crimes. He started forging Picasso etchings, artificially aging them and selling them through legitimate auction houses by claiming he found them in his grandmother's attic.
It's a classic scam.
When that got old, he started printing counterfeit $10 bills, which eventually caught up to him and landed him in federal prison.
He had a pathological need to outsmart the system, whether it was through the chemistry of aging fake art, counterfeiting currency, or directing underground film. But for Ray, all of these actions, the drugs, the forgeries, the extreme sexual films, even the 2006 simulated snuff film he directed, where he actually played a serial killer, were contained within what he considered his art.
A very loose definition of art.
Very. It was all part of his grand game against society.
And that brings us to the devastating pivot in our deep dive today. Because we are moving away from the past and slamming right into the present. We are moving from Ray Horsch's self-described performance art of violence to the chilling, actual reality currently unfolding with his son.
This is where the comfortable distance of historical true crime completely evaporates.
Let's look closely at this Hindustan Times report from August 2026. Eugene Horsch, who is 44 years old, was recently arrested in the only neighborhood of Philadelphia.
What did they find?
When authorities raided his property, he was in possession of loaded guns and fraudulent DEA and FBI identification badges.
Which immediately echoes his father's early days. Ray used to impersonate officials and engage in illegal wiretapping. You can clearly see the inherited behavioral traits. But Eugene's situation escalates into something far more macabre than forgery or wiretapping.
When investigators searched Eugene's house, they found a hard drive. And the graphic videos contained on that hard drive led Philadelphia police to announce that two missing women are now officially believed to be dead.
Oh, my.
Maribel Fresses, who had been missing since 2018, and Gabriella Amarondo, who vanished back in 2012.
And the scope of this tragedy just keeps expanding. Two other missing women have been definitively linked to the Olney house, Blair Tonzelli, who disappeared in 2023. In fact, at the time of Eugene's arrest, a woman with him actually handed police an identification card belonging to Blair.
But it's the fourth woman that truly bridges these two sources in the most horrifying, unthinkable way.
Yeah, this is the part that is just chilling.
The fourth woman linked to this house is Amy McHale. Amy went missing in 2016, and Amy McHale was married to Ray Horsch. She was Eugene's stepmother.
Let's map that timeline out. Ray Horsch died in 2025. This means Amy vanished without a trace while she was actively married to Ray, and now a full decade later, she is tied to the horrors discovered in his son's home.
So what does this all mean? The rumors swirling online right now are intense. There's heavy, dark speculation that Eugene and Ray might have actually operated as a serial killer duo.
The physical evidence is certainly disturbing.
Authorities have found deeply disturbing evidence in Eugene's possession, including extensive writings referencing the notorious serial killer Ted Bundy, alongside mentions of zip ties, a drum, and a chilling note about trash that needs to go.
Wow.
The media is already comparing Eugene to Gary Heidnik, the infamous Philadelphia serial killer from the 1980s who built a literal pit in his basement to imprison women.
This raises an important question about the nature of Ray Horsch's lifelong claims. For decades, Ray sat in interviews, calmly explaining away his violent films, his simulated snuff movies, and his rough live performances.
Like it was all just an act.
Right. He claimed he was just exploring the psychology of abusive relationships. He insisted he was a sociopath, sure, but one who channeled his darkness into creative, victimless rebellion.
He called it artistic commentary. He insisted his obsession with taboo and violence against women was safely contained within the frame of his camera lens.
But when you look at the devastating reality of the Olney Mystery House, when you look at four missing women, including his own wife, linked to his family property, we have to confront the tragic human cost.
You really do.
It forces us to ask if his dark obsessions ever truly stopped being art. It strips away all the artistic pretense Ray used to shield himself and leaves nothing but brutal, raw violence.
It really takes you on journey, doesn't it? For you listening, we've gone from the nostalgic, brightly colored, innocent set of Sesame Street, wandering down into the gritty, mob-run porn theaters of 1970s Times Square, navigating through mob-funded films and disastrous Latin black masses, straight into a modern-day true crime nightmare unfolding right now in Philadelphia.
Quite the trajectory.
It's a stark reminder of why digging into historical context is so vital. You literally cannot understand the horror of Eugene Horsch's Olney house without understanding the twisted, boundary-pushing legacy of his father.
The history provides the psychological bedrock for the current tragedy. It shows us how a lifelong dedication to dismantling moral boundaries, even under the guise of art, can eventually cascade into actual, irreversible human destruction.
Exactly. Ray Horsch spent his entire life hiding his depravity behind the label of underground analog art. Because it was the 1970s, he could claim his extreme simulated violence was just a fleeting performance, safely captured on a reel of 16mm film that eventually faded away.
But we live in a very different world now.
We do. Eugene's horrors weren't projected in a smoky Times Square theater. They were locked onto a digital hard drive, creating an indelible, permanent footprint. Which leaves you with this to ponder. As we move further into an era where every dark action is digitally preserved, are we finally stripping away the ability of sociopaths to hide their real-world monsters behind the comfortable analog excuse of performance art?
That is a chilling thought. The digital age might be the ultimate destroyer of the artistic alibi.
It really makes you rethink the media we consume. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us.